This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And as you are shopping for the holidays and holiday baking, it's pretty likely that you've purchased a lot of sugar. And right now in the country, there is a growing concern over sugar and where it comes from. The United States Customs and Border Protection has blocked shipments of raw sugar from a top Dominican producer after finding indications of forced labor at one of its Caribbean plantations. This follows a federal probe that was in part inspired by a two-year investigation by journalist Sandy Tolan and Haitian-Dominican journalist Euclides Cordero Noel. They reported for Reveal, Mother Jones, and Intercept. I'm joined now by lead reporter Sandy Tolan. Thank you so much for your time today, Sandy.
Good to be here, Ashley. Thanks.
And the episode of Reveal, this is the audio version of the story, aired already once, but it will be airing this Saturday at 1 p.m. right here on Prairie Public. Sandy, now I mentioned that this follows a 2 years of reporting, but your reporting in the Dominican Republic actually goes back more than two decades, 3 decades ago. You really get a sense of what you were feeling while you were doing these reporting trips. Let's play a clip from one of your earliest reporting trips of just how you are experiencing seeing this firsthand.
Walking down this dirt street, and each house is surrounded by standing black water, which is just human waste and garbage. Kids playing around this water. It's a breeding ground for mosquitoes. It's a really poor place.
Sandy, horrendous working and living conditions. That was 30 years ago. Now they are still in trouble today for some of these conditions, but things have improved. What's changed?
Right now, the situation is better in the terms of there not being child labor, very, very little, if any. And the conditions have improved in terms of now not being people locked behind caged barracks guarded with shotguns. But the situation now is not, the forced labor isn't really defined that way anymore. The International Labor Organization has 11 indicators of forced labor, and that's what the U.S. and Customs Border Protections looks like. That's what it looks at, rather. And while labor has no enforcement power, Customs, the Department of Labor, which had been monitoring for years, Customs does. And in the recent ban, they found, Customs found 5 indicators of forced labor: abuse of vulnerability, isolation, withholding of wages, excessive overtime, and abusive working and living conditions. And that's arguably the thing that that Euclides and I saw the most.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about cane cutters and their families who are so hungry that they actually stand in crowded lines waiting for church groups to give them little bags of beans and rice and cooking oil. They live in these ramshackle company-owned houses, very isolated, miles from the nearest town. 90% have no electricity. The homes have no running water. In more than 50 interviews we did, the workers spoke of inadequate protective gear, poor medical care, low pay, and chronic debt. Almost every family we spoke with was in debt, and most of them talked about the interest rate of 10% per week. Mm-hmm. That comes to 520% annually. So they just can't get out of poverty. There was an Inter-American Human Rights Commission report in 2015 that focused on a number of Batés, including one, at least one, I think several from Central Romana, that was scathing, and it talked about how people are just trapped. They can't get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. Someone like Euclides was able to, but the vast majority cannot.
Right. We're talking they're making $3 to $4 a day working under these extreme conditions, being subject to really terrible poisons at times. And this, Sandy, is not the kind of story that is very easy to set up in advance. You really need to be going there and seeing things. And there is part of the reporting where you get chased off by armed guards.
Yeah, that happened on a number of occasions, actually. I should clarify that the company says it has raised the wages since our reports came out. There are some indication that it's up closer to $6 or $7 a day for the minimum. We haven't verified that. Some of them still appear to be lower, but just to qualify that. But yeah, we saw, you know, at one point when we were actually recording these evangelical Christian group from a nearby town handing out these little tiny bags of food after people heard their preaching, proselytizing, then they handed these tiny bags of food. We were recording that, and there was a guard who got increasingly agitated. He literally fingered his Smith & Wesson 45, which was in his holster, and then he started screaming at us to get out. And, you know, we complied. We left. I kept saying, why can't we record it? He's like, you know, you're not authorized. I'm going to have you arrested if you don't leave. So, of course, we left. And we also documented this, this happened more than once and this kind of thing. We also documented for The Intercept more recently a paramilitary style security detail that serves as a nocturnal eviction force for Central Romana workers who have fallen out of favor with the company. Maybe they've complained or they're too old and they're not productive anymore. So, they're the sense of intimidation and fear is very common. And in fact, right now, people, you know, I wouldn't go into the Bates right now because everybody has been told not to talk to outsiders. We don't want to endanger other people. And also, we don't want to endanger ourselves. The last bit of reporting we did was very complicated. There was phone calls. There was meetings in hotels and very kind of cloak and dagger. I usually don't work that way, but that was the only way to get some of this work done.
You mentioned the Central Romana Corporation. How big of a producer is this company? How much sugar are we talking about here?
We're talking about a lot of sugar, Ashley. We're talking about almost 300 million pounds of sugar sent to the U.S. last year by this company, which is one of the world's biggest exporters of sugar to the U.S. The country, the Dominican Republic, is the second largest of all the countries that export sugar to the U.S. And Central Romana has almost two-thirds of what's known as the trade quotient. So they get a preferential treatment to get their sugar into the country. And on top of that, everybody who sells sugar, whether the domestic or foreign producers in the United States, gets about, on average over the years, 10 cents a pound extra because of congressionally authorized price supports. That includes beet sugar, too, and all domestic cane sugar. So, you know, that doesn't sound like very much, right? But then figure 300 million pounds. Do the math. That's $30 million. Just that. And that's the extra above the world market price. And sometimes it's more than, you know, closer to 15 cents a pound. So as a result, Central Romana, which is owned by the Von Hul family of Florida, which bought Central Romana in 1984, they have taken some of this, their profits, and invested it wisely from their perspective in political influence. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars over the years to politicians on both sides of the aisle. Right. One brother is a Republican, one brother is a Democrat. So they're friends with the Clintons. You know, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary under Donald Trump, and his wife were close friends with the Republican brother. And what happens is that there's this tremendous amount of influence, not only in the Dominican Republic, where the former president of Central Romana was also the vice president of the country, of the Dominican Republic, and the ambassador to the U.S. and foreign minister of the Dominican Republic, but also in Washington, where you have dozens and dozens of representatives and Congress people, senators rather, and on also political lobbying that gets put into the system in Washington and helps ensure that those price supports stay in place. And the return on investment, according to one agricultural economist I spoke with, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 1. For every dollar they spend, their profit might be around 15 bucks. So when you're talking about millions, tens of millions, you can imagine, just do the math on how much the big sugar is making.
So is this part of why it took 30 years to see a lot of progress? What does it mean now that the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol is blocking shipments from this producer?
Yeah. So Customs and Border Protection has an enforcement wing. What happened, in the early 2000s is this all started going, we were there in the 90s. Then a Catholic priest named Christopher Hartley, who's Spanish and British, came down there, and his constituents, so to speak, his parishioners were in the sugarcane plantation of another company known as the Vicini Group, and their conditions were really awful. And Father Hartley started making a lot of noise, and he became kind of a persona non grata. Got a number of death threats, not clear from exactly where they were coming. He was forced out of the country, but began working with a sympathetic official in the Department of Labor, former State Department person, who then left her positions in the government and helped him make a case to the Department of Labor, which made this finding in the early 2000s, or 2012 or so, that the Labor Department was going to begin monitoring all of the cane areas in the Dominican Republic for signs of forced labor. But they famously, and they would tell you this, that we don't have any enforcement power. And so they would issue these reports saying there continues to be indications of forced labor, but it's getting a little better. And this went on for like 10 years. And I remember interviewing Hartley a couple of years ago, Father Hartley, and he said, I'm fed up with this. There's not any action. Well, then U.S. Customs got involved, and they do have enforcement power. About a year ago, at least, they began looking into that. From our reporting, they don't speak, on the record. They don't speak to you, so it's hard to know exactly when the investigation started. But we've been getting wind that something might be coming down for several months. And then, of course, Customs and Border Protection acted just very recently, the day before Thanksgiving, actually.
Yeah. What do you think will be the fallout of this? How will it impact the people whose lives are actually, threatened by this?
Yeah, this is a great and a difficult question, because here's the thing. I mean, when the Fanhul Corporation, through its company Florida Crystals and U.S. Sugar, the two big actors in Florida, were sued by labor lawyers representing Jamaican and other Caribbean cane cutters cutting cane in Florida, like in the 80s and 90s, they won. They won a couple, at least one major lawsuit. And so you'd say, okay, well, great. There's going to be reforms. But what happened? The companies essentially mechanized overnight. And all of those Jamaicans and other Caribbean cane cutters went home. There's some concern that this could happen again. There are some rumblings that maybe 30,000 people could be out of work. A lot of people think this is nonsense. It's scare tactics. that they have too much invested in the cane cutting, manual hand labor, to just, you know, they're already mechanized somewhat, but that they need these, they want to continue to have the hand labor. So there's a lot of worry, but the company has indicated in its English statement that they disagree with the decision, but they're willing to work with the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. In Spanish, they released a completely different statement for domestic consumption. I mean, Dominican Republic is a country that's been invaded by the United States military twice in the 20th century. So people are understandably not big fans of the Yankees, of the United States government and its military. Mm. So Dominican Republic companies like Central Romana, you know, they know how to play the nationalist card. And they basically said, we are proud of what we've always done here. Of course, they are the biggest employer in the country. They're the biggest landowner in the country. They own nearly 250,000 acres, most of it in cane. So what's going to happen is really hard to say, Ashley. I know that there is a lot of anxiety in the country now just from what's a somewhat of a separate story but overlapping, which is these mass deportations of Haitians, so much so that I read one report that said we're not sure there's going to be enough people to work the harvest, which starts just in the next couple of days. So that's not clear. But the situation is rife with fear and anxiety and potential concerns over potential violence. It got to the point where the State Department, and again, this is only tangentially related, but it's relevant to our discussion, they issued a travel warning for Black Americans intending to go to the Dominican Republic, particularly darker-skinned Black Americans who the State Department was concerned might have bad encounters with the Dominican immigration authorities. So it's kind of, to say the least, in flux, and there's a lot of concern and anxiety and frustration. And of course, a lot of the people in the country totally support Central Romana, and they're furious. I mean, one person I talked to who's been involved in some of the documenting of this said that he's been called an enemy of the state. Now, whether that's from an official or a company person, I don't think so. But that's the kind of atmosphere that people are dealing with right now.
Wow. We've talked about the fact that there have been some improvements over 30 years, but that those improvements were really, I mean, people being locked in cages and being surrounded by sewage. There's a lot of room for improvement there. Let's hear a clip that's from a more recent one of your trips about meeting workers and seeing what kinds of equipment and what kinds of concerns they're having.
In Bate 80, Euclides and I arrive as an after-work baseball game is in full swing in the dirt streets. The workers we meet here say they've gotten repeatedly sick from spraying herbicides, severe headaches, backaches, dizziness, nausea, double vision. More than 30 workers in multiple Central Romana Bates described a range of these symptoms. More than half of those cited insufficient protective equipment like ripped aprons, loose-fitting boots, and faulty masks. This man says he sometimes sprays herbicides for a week without a working mask.
And they don't care about it.
And
they say, tomorrow we back and bring you new one. And they don't appear with the new one.
He's not the only one complaining of lax safety protocols. One fumigator we interviewed showed us how he mixes big vats of chemicals in an open barrel with a stick. And then we meet another worker who says he fell gravely ill after spraying herbicides. This man's name is Raoul Jean Herville. Raoul is 49. He migrated from the eroded lands of Haiti's northern coast about 20 years ago and has worked the cane ever since. For the last 2 years, he says he's sprayed chemicals for Central Romana. During that time, he was diagnosed with HIV. Raul says because of the chemical spraying, he also had trouble breathing.
El producto que hace daño a mí. Como yo siento maloso todo el día.
After a year of fumigating work, Raul tells us, he started getting the flu.
La gripe.
Fever.
Fiebre.
Then came the rashes, burning skin. His respiratory problems grew worse. In November 2018, Raul tells us, he collapsed on the job.
Yo caí el 28 de noviembre, 2018.
His fellow fumigators took him to the hospital, the public hospital, not Central Romanas, where he was diagnosed not only as HIV positive, but with tuberculosis. Raul believes the exposure to herbicides nearly killed him and that his bosses didn't care.
If you die,
it's your problem. They don't say anything.
Sandy, the reporting goes into so much detail about the working conditions and the lack of access to medical care and the substandard wages and living conditions. It reminds me of, you know, NPR has recent reports on people dying in building the stadium in Qatar for the World Cup. There's multiple reports on slavery and smartphones and coffee and chocolate and diamonds. And now this big report on sugar. What do you hope that consumers take away from listening to something like this about what to think about when they make purchases?
Yeah, it's such an age-old question. I mean, I think as a journalist, I mean, I don't want to advocate a particular course of action for any consumer. You know, it's not that what we want to do is help create awareness. People can decide what they want to do with that awareness. Some people are like, well, hey, I like sugar and that's too bad, but that's the way it is around the world. Or, you know, I'm not going to give up my iPhone. I mean, I've, you know, for a long time as a journalist reporting in all these different countries, I've wanted to try to make the connection between the lives that are so remote and then our lives, and sometimes often through products. I've done work on oil in Ecuador and what the raising of the rainforest in Ecuador for Texaco and Conoco has done to the local folks there, including a lot of indigenous people, or the artisanal fishermen in Honduras and how the Honduran military basically took away their lands in order to have an export deal of shrimp to the United States. You know, other kinds of products as well. And sugar has long been something that I've been interested. You know, there's all kinds of questions about the health effects of sugar. I'm, you know, we haven't explored that with our reporting. There's tons of books and other studies out there. But I think what I would like to do as a journalist, including on this story, is just help create awareness. And then people can decide for themselves. You know, that's the sort of what got me into journalism in the first place, is this belief in freedom of information, freedom of exchange, accurate storytelling, compelling storytelling, and then let the chips fall. Let people decide for themselves in an informed democracy how they want to respond.
That's Sandy Tolan, the lead reporter on The Bitter Work Behind Sugar. That is the episode of Reveal airing this Saturday at 1 p.m. Central. Other reporting partners here with Mother Jones and The Intercept. Sandy, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to talk to you, Ashley. Thanks for all the good questions.
We'll have more Main Street after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. With demand for air travel increasing, North Dakota airports have been working with the carriers to fly larger aircraft to help meet that demand. And North Dakota Aeronautics Commission Executive Director Kyle Warner says that has been happening.
There's a transition between the 50-seat small regional jets to the larger 70-plus seat jets, and that's a good thing.
Warner says he thinks that trend will continue because of the economics.
The airlines actually prefer to use larger aircraft, and they obviously want to do whatever they can to make sure those flights are as full as possible.
But Warner says that's being tempered a bit by workforce issues.
It makes it difficult like we were saying before, if there's a workforce shortage, if there's a pilot shortage, to add additional capacity immediately. But over time, you know, we expect to continue to see that growth to occur.
Passenger numbers have been rising since the COVID pandemic has eased. Rural America is continuing to get older. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports new data show for the first time ever, more than one in five rural residents is over the age of 65.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's annual Rural America at a Glance report shows that more than 20% of rural residents are over 65, compared to 16% in urban areas. Mary Hendrickson is a professor of rural sociology at the University of Missouri. She says there's no silver bullet to reverse the trend.
There's federal issues, there's state issues, there's community issues, there's regional issues. Can we start thinking about this as, you know, regional networks and so on? There is not just one thing.
Hendrickson says rural areas need to make things better for families, and that can include everything from better broadband access to establishing reliable daycare and preschool options. I'm Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And 17 Minnesota community-based organizations will share in $2.4 million in state grants meant to expand childcare options. Minnesota state economic officials say the money can be used to help finance new facilities, provide training, or otherwise clear barriers to childcare. Economic Commissioner Steve Grove says these grants should result in 2,700 additional childcare slots.
Childcare comes up again and again as the number one thing that's holding back people from getting into the workforce. In fact, the Minneapolis Fed has done some research on this, and of the prime-aged working adults in Minnesota who aren't getting into the labor market, 26% of them cite as their reason for not being able to work to be childcare.
Statewide, Minnesota officials estimate a need of up to 90,000 more slots in affordable, quality childcare programs. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bell Bank, an independently owned regional bank dedicated to offering customers a memorable banking experience and giving back to make our communities even better. Learn more at bell.bank. Member FDIC.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on Friday's news director, Dave Thompson, joins us from our Bismarck studio to talk about the week's biggest stories. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You are very welcome, Ashley.
So North Dakota's trigger abortion law is going to the Supreme Court, or it is
right.
At the Supreme Court.
It's in the Supreme Court, and arguments were heard this week. And what it is that the judge, Bruce Romanek from Bismarck, issued basically a temporary restraining order until that some matters could be adjudicated. And there is still some question in his mind and others' minds, you know, how far does this go? Is there some constitutional protection in the North Dakota Constitution for the right to an abortion? Well, the Attorney General maintains there is not, and the legislators who passed that trigger ban did so kind of with the thought that maybe Roe versus Wade was not going to be overturned. So they did it just in case. And this high idea of a doctor having to have an affirmative defense really raises some questions among some in the legal community.
Right.
And what I'm saying is that, you know, the doctor would have to prove that a rape had occurred, incest had occurred, that there was really a threat to the life of the woman. So that there's some interesting questions that have to be answered. And how the Supreme Court's going to rule on that, I really don't have any idea. I listened to the arguments, and the arguments were fascinating. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, on both sides, I would imagine.
Absolutely on both sides.
Do you have a sense of when they would be deciding on this?
I would think it would be sooner rather than later, but there is no time frame for them to do that. Because that the restraining order is going to stay in place until they lift it.
Okay. Attorney General Drew Wrigley says that the email retention policy is nearly ready. And this goes back to the late Attorney General Wayne Stengem. After his death, some emails were deleted and a lot of people raising questions and, you know, saying that raises a lot of red flags. So what's with the policy? What have they decided?
Well, let me just tell you that first off, they had ITD hire an outside consultant to take a look. The outside consultant said, no, these email accounts are gone, so the email is not going to be there. And he is going to have some policy saying there are some routine emails that you can delete. perhaps, you know, like somebody, can I go to lunch, something like that. But if it does has to do with matters of policy in the department, he wants those kept. And yeah, it is going to probably put a little bit of strain on some of the server and space on servers.
Yeah.
But he says that these are important documents and, you know, may be part of the state's history and are part of the state's history.
And when you say kept, are we talking 7 years like a tax return or more indefinitely?
Well, he hasn't worked that out just yet. And I asked him specifically, do you think state law has to be strengthened or more, shall we say, narrowly drawn in order that emails are not deleted? And he says, well, state law provides guidelines, so it might be up to each elected official. He believes that each elected official should have a policy on these things and the emails should be kept.
Okay. Yeah. So this policy is specific to the Attorney General's office.
Right. Until we might see legislation in the upcoming session. Nobody's mentioned it just yet, but, you know, the session's coming up in January.
Right, yeah, and it'll be a busy one.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Lawmakers are proposing spending limits, a change in the spending limits for the North Dakota Emergency Commission. Set us up with why they think they need spending limits changed.
Well, at that point, you know, that the Emergency Commission was kind of responsible for making decisions about how unknown federal money is going to be spent or unknown special fund money that's coming in. Agencies would make the request to the Emergency Commission, and they could make a recommendation. Well, given the fact there was so much money coming in for COVID relief, the legislature said they wanted to get a handle on it too, so they put limits on it. But the limits are kind of low, and they determined that the governor is saying, okay, more federal dollars are coming down through such things as the Infrastructure Act. And we may have to take a look at expanding these limits because I don't want to call a legislative session every 3-4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if it comes down to that, I'm not saying it's going to. But he's saying, okay, let's do something about these limits. Well, an interim committee of the legislature is going to propose basically kind of doubling the limits, but it's going to be based on a percentage of the general fund rather than a hard and fast limit on money that can be spent.
Okay. And when it comes to spending within these limits, how much freedom does the Emergency Commission have to spend that money, you know, with or without various types of approval?
Well, you've still got the budget section. Some of these things will have to go to the legislature's budget section for approval there. And that has been a bone of contention in the past because mm-hmm. the budget section is not the entire legislature. But yeah, there still is an approval process, and the state agencies have to make their case to the Emergency Commission, which, by the way, has a majority of legislators on it. So that tells you something, too.
Yeah, for sure. There is also a news story this week. The Public Service Commission has approved a new wind farm to be built near Wishick.
Right. Now, this was a bone of contention because mm-hmm. when they had the public hearing in the Wishick area, a representative of the coal industry said, hey, wait a second. There's a need for more transmission there, and they're worried about, you know, some kind of congestion on the power lines. And they're worried that, you know, these coal-fired power plants, which are still up and running, may lose their space on the transmission.
Mm.
So that was a concern that was raised, but the independent system operator, MISO, which is the Midwest Independent System Operator, which is a controlled transmission, and also the Southwest Power Pool have plans to expand transmission in that area, and which is weird because that's right in south-central North Dakota, and a lot of things are coming together right at that point.
Hmm.
But they're going to expand transmission, and it's going to cost a bit. And the worry among Commissioner Christman and some others is that ratepayers are going to pay that cost, which is probably true, but how much is it going to cost? So
right.
He was worried about approving this before there's really an amount known about cost.
Okay. Because those kinds of rate hikes tend to be more permanent than interim,
that is correct,
right?
Yes.
Okay. What does the Midwest Independent System Operator, like, do you know what they take into account when they're deciding those transmissions and who gets what space?
There's a lot of factors at play, and I know some of them but not all of them. Commissioner Fedorchuk, who is the chairman of the Public Service Commission, is on the MISO board, so she understands. And Commissioner Christman's on the SPP board, so they are more intimately aware of what goes on. But yeah, there has been a move toward more renewables, as you might expect. And it is interesting that we're talking about this as renewables are ramping up and coal-fired power plants are still operating and are providing that baseload power.
Okay. There is a research project that is focusing on what's called critical minerals, and this is a lignite research project. So what is a critical mineral?
These are minerals that are used in things like computers and other electronics. And we apparently are doing a lot of importation from places like China. Well, they have found out that these rare earth minerals are in lignite deposits. Mm. They can be in outcroppings, but they can be in the coal mines themselves. So they're looking for ways, if it makes it feasible, to go into the mines and extract these minerals. That's what the research project is going to be about. Mm. And that will probably extend the life of these coal mines, but will give them a chance to do some repurposing.
And that could really impact U.S. trade with China.
It could. And a lot of people were saying that we should be less dependent. We should find these rare earth minerals. I'll give you a preview of what might be happening next week. You know about lithium. Mm-hmm. Lithium is used for batteries. Mm-hmm. Well, there's going to be a research project that's going to be talked about getting lithium out of produced water in the Bakken, which that could be very interesting. So
wow.
I'm watching that one.
Yeah, that will be really interesting. There is a lot of reporting these days on these rare earth minerals. In
right.
Gulf,
and it's amazing that what they've been able to find in North Dakota, besides the oil and the coal and the natural gas, you have perhaps rare earth minerals and lithium.
Hmm. Basin Electric proposing an expansion of its Pioneer Generation Station.
Right, and that's a natural gas peaker plant. They're going to have more than 500 megawatts added to it. They'd like to do that anyway. And they said it's because of demand out there in northwest North Dakota as we're seeing these server farms and cryptocurrency. Don't ask me to explain cryptocurrency.
Yeah, no.
I do not understand that at all.
I've listened and it's never sunk in.
Me either. But there was really interested in doing that crypto mining out there.
Hmm.
And you need a lot of power to run these server farms. So this is one way that, you know, Basin and its member cooperatives are going to meet that power demand.
Right. Man, it seems like it must be an exciting time to be on the Public Service Commission.
There's
just
an awful lot going,
all of these
yes.
things coming together. I'm like, oh, yeah, and they keep coming back to the PSC.
They certainly do, because the PSC has a lot of say in siting.
Yeah, wow. NDSU gathering input on how to strategize for budget cuts because they are taking some hard hits, $10 million over 3 years, right?
Right, and that's due to declining enrollment. And they said, we'll, you know, try to get some of this back in the upcoming legislative session. Maybe they can increase some, but they need to make some decisions now. And what I'm understanding is they're going to try to combine some of the departments, maybe just under one department head, and maybe saving some money that way.
Mm.
And they think they can come up with maybe close to $10 million in doing that.
Have they said which departments they'd combine?
I'm not exactly sure yet, but I think there's, you know, some study of that, and depending on what they come out with.
Okay. And we have a story here from the YWCA of Cass Clay. This is a $2.5 million grant, the largest private gift in the local Y's history.
Right, and it has to do with their efforts to find housing for the homeless and housing for people who need temporary housing. So apparently they were asked to apply by this firm. So I think
Day One Families Fund.
The Day One, which is really interesting. They've given a lot of grants around the nation, but North Dakota's YWCA of Cass Clay got a pretty sizable grant in order to proceed with some of these things they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not aware that they had purchased an old nuns' convent in Fargo to provide more of this temporary housing.
Okay. And is that what the bulk of the grant will be for, is temporary housing?
Well, that'll be a lot of the grant, but there's going to be some upgrades to the housing that exists, and there's going to be some building upgrades. They have to do that too. And they're looking at some other programs for sustainability.
All right. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ashley.
Madeline is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the FM Area Foundation, offering the Caring Catalog, a giving platform listing needs of local nonprofit organizations this holiday season. You can learn more at areafoundation.org. FM Area Foundation, connecting people and purpose.
I have a weird one for you, at least weird for me. It's UFFTA, spelled UFF, and then maybe there's an apostrophe, sometimes yes, sometimes no, DA.
Join us this week on Away with Words.
Well, if you're willing to work out in East Jesus Nowhere, then you can make a lot of money.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear the fanfare, it's time for another movie review from Matt Olean. Matt, there is this expression when you're in love with someone, you love them warts and all.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got a love movie called Bones and All. And I read this and I thought, am I reading this correctly? This is a love story about cannibals.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And believe it or not, the director, Luca Guadagnino, who did Call Me By Your Name mm-hmm. and the remake of Suspiria, pulls it off. I really like this movie. It's probably, along with Tar, my favorite movie of the year so far. Neither movie are going to make any money. They're not movies that people are going to flock to see. But
I watched the trailer. Again, it's intense.
We have very intelligent listeners to this show, and I will tell them, you know, the goriness is not as bad as you think. And if you want to be challenged and see something different, this is the movie I would suggest they go to. So it's based on a novel by Camille DeAngelis in 2015, which won some book awards. It is about two young drifters. Taylor Russell plays the girl. She's about 18 years old. And Timothée Chalamet from Call Me By Your Name and Dune plays this younger man, probably early 20s, that she meets up with in the Midwest. So early on, we know the Taylor Russell character, she's a cannibal. She eats normal food too, but she loves to munch on people as well. That's part of her disease, her condition. And she embarks on kind of a road trip through the Midwest. And I think what really works about this movie is the sense of place. So we go through the upper Midwest, the plains, dingy settings, convenience stores, carnivals, buildings, and you kind of get it's a road movie. It's a road movie and it's a love story movie on the road. Eventually, she meets up with Chalamet, who also has the same affliction. Mark Rylance from Bridge of Spies has a great supporting performance, very creepy. I think he'll be Oscar nominated as well. So along the way, she meets people that have this same affliction, same condition. But what it really is, it's a road movie about young love. So the Chalamet character and the Taylor Russell character, they're really bonded together by their condition, but it's also a love story. And let me tell you, to pull off the fine line of a movie between disgusting and tenderness is hard to do, and it pulls it off. So
wow.
It is a tender love story between these two young lovers who are kind of escaping their lives, chasing something. How do they fit in? How do they fit into the world? But this road movie takes us through Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Nebraska, Minnesota. There is a Fergus Falls, Minnesota angle in this movie. Can't give it away. Very crucial. So it's very local. Great cameos by Chloe Sevigny in this movie and also by Michael Stuhlbarg. The cameos you won't forget when you see them. I really like this movie a lot. I would say it's Terrence Malick's Badlands meets Silence of the Lambs meets Bonnie and Clyde and Little Dracula thrown in. But the sense of place is so good in this movie. You feel like you're on the road trip with them,
mm-hmm.
and it is creepy. There's a lot of creepy scenes. But how Guadagnino paints this as the young love story it tends to rise above kind of a normal horror movie to this tender young love movie. And it's an amazing balancing act that he pulls off between disgusting and tenderness.
Well, it's fascinating to have this idea of you know, it's one of the write-ups that I read was about people on the fringes of society. So even if you are not a cannibal, which most of us aren't, you know, is there this sense of like you can identify with just that idea of you don't belong here?
Yes. So I think that's, again, that's a crucial part of this movie is that when Taylor Russell meets Timothée Chalamet, there's this instant connection. They both have endured kind of the similar things. They're ostracized from their parents. They don't know how they got this condition. Mm. And, you know, along the way, I want to say there are strange things that happen. I mean, there is a Bonnie and Clyde element to this film, a Badlands. If people have seen Terrence Malick's Badlands, it's kind of the Charles Starkweather killings back in Kansas in the 50s. Martin Sheen, Sissy Spacek, that's a movie I would recommend people see. Mm. So there's elements of bad choices in here in the film as well. But ultimately, kind of the wide-eyed innocence of Taylor Russell, the actress, really pulls it off. It's really her movie. Chalamet is the bigger star, but she is the central performance in the movie, and it's a wonderful performance. And like I said, Mark Rylance, I don't want to give too much away about his performance, but he is creepy beyond belief, and I can see a supporting nomination. He is a past winner, of course, for the Oscar for Bridge of Spies, but I can see a supporting nomination coming his way. But I just loved this road trip through the Midwest, and they don't have much money. You know, they meet weird people. They meet weird people at a carnival, weird people here. And it's just – it's a fascinating movie. A little bit of Jack Kerouac's On the Road as well thrown in. A lot of different influences, I would say.
Well, in using a phrase like wide-eyed innocence and in framing it about a movie about cannibals, and then you contrast it with something like The Silence of the Lambs, where he, you know, seemed to delight in eating people, you get the sense in the trailer that she doesn't delight in this.
No, but she has to have it. She has to have it. It's an affliction that must be fed at some point.
She's wrestling.
But she has a line in the sand she won't cross. Hmm. And again, go see the movie because these lines in the sand, you know, where do you cross the line in the sand? Are we going to munch on a dead person?
How do they come across?
Or are we
going
to make a person die to munch on them? Yeah. So that's where the line in the sand becomes very interesting. She does have a moral compass, and she plays – Taylor Russell is in her 20s, but she plays an 18-year-old kind of runaway student. So there's a lot of people on the way that want to take advantage of her. And it's really it's not a showy performance by her, but she is the star of the movie and she could get an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. I'm kind of hearing through the grapevine. She's right on kind of that edge. Cate Blanchett for sure, Michelle Yeoh. I think those are guaranteed locks for actress nominations, but Taylor Russell could get in there. So I recommend seeing this if you want something different.
Well, I mentioned The Silence of the Lambs, probably the most famous movie about cannibals. Correct me if I'm wrong
here. I would say so.
It was the third movie to win the Big Five, Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Director, and Writing. It was also nominated for two other Oscars.
Editing?
Mm-hmm.
Editing, and I will say sound.
Sound, yes.
Okay. And for our listeners, It Happened One Night, 1934, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975, were the other two movies to win the Big Five.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents an afternoon of fun for all ages on Saturday, February 5th at 3 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. Special guest Caitlin Vogel, Miss North Dakota, USA, will narrate Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. High school soloist Hayden Fredrickson will perform David Gillingham's Concerto No. 2 for marimba and orchestra. Other works include the Jamaican Rumba, Swedish Polka, and much more. Live or live stream tickets are available at MinotSymphony.com or at 701-858-4228.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 2nd. A coal miner was murdered near Kenmare in late November of 1912, and it doesn't appear his death was ever solved. The deceased was Carl Hansen, a 29-year-old born in Norway. A Soo Line section foreman discovered his body near the shore of Del Axe Lake after following a bloody trail from the tracks. Hansen had been beaten on the head with a metal bar and robbed. On this date in 1912, the newspaper readers learned the details of an inquest into Hansen's death. 16 witnesses testified. Evidence suggested two or more assailants attacked Hansen and threw his body over a 5-foot barbed wire fence and dragged it to the lakeshore. Strewn around his body were a shoe, a stocking, a gray felt hat, a black and bloody sateen shirt, a Seamen's Union membership card, two razors, a pipe, and a package of tobacco. The inquest revealed that Hansen might have carried money in his stocking. Former sailor W.R. Casey was arrested for vagrancy and held in jail in connection with the killing. Casey was charged with murder, but was later released for lack of evidence. He did plead guilty to attempted jailbreaking and was sentenced to 6 months. Allegations suggested Casey had visited a house of ill fame near Kenmare on the night of the killing and might have brought Hansen with him. From there, on their way home, Hansen might have been ambushed. Also, the section foreman who found Hansen's body alleged that Casey and another man were prowling around his home on the night of the killing and that Casey even entered the house before being kicked out. Authorities also arrested a minor named Mickey Burns, but he was able to produce 5 witnesses who corroborated his alibi, and a judge let him go after a hearing in Minot. After January of 1913, the case disappears from North Dakota newspapers, so it's doubtful that anyone was ever held responsible for Carl Hansen's death. Authorities kept his body for about a week, but no family member came forward to claim his remains. He was buried in Rose Hill Cemetery in Kenmare. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Hi, I'm Tom Russo. On the next Great American Folk Show, English folk artist Olivia Cheney.
It's been too long that I've held you in my grip.
L.A. Psych Surf Trio Pacific Sunset.
The summer day.
Plus music from Minneapolis singer-songwriter Luke LeBlanc and an interview with Ronnie Robbins, son of country royalty Marty Robbins. The Great American Folk Show. Listen Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you tune in all next week for more conversations telling North Dakota's story.